How are you doing?
Fairly well. How are you, good sir?
I am very well. Just drinking orange juice.
With champagne?
No. Just a virgin orange juice.
A virgin.
It's no, what is the...
Mimosa.
What are they called? Mimosa, yeah. I couldn't get the word out.
Yep. I'd be a little... Well, that's what they're for, though, is early drinking. Usually they serve those at brunches.
Yeah.
Those and Bloody Marys.
That's your drink of choice, right?
Yeah, I like those a lot better. I like it spicy.
Tomato sauce and vodka? What is that?
Tomato juice. Yeah, it's a big can of Prego.
Spaghetti and vodka.
They do have vodka sauce.
Yeah, I'm sure they have vodka everything.
Vodka comic books. Instead of smelling like old paper, it smells like Russia. But we don't want vodka, we want wine. The women and the wine.
Mm-hmm. The women and the wine. The wine and the women and the women and the wine.
Did you watch Buck this time?
I did. Okay. I did my homework.
Just making sure I wasn't confusing you.
Uh-uh.
By my reference. That actually...
The women in the wine was what it was all about in this episode.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it kind of helps me figure out why Keith Knutson hates comics now.
Because he's a satyr.
He got turned into a satyr, and all he wants is the beer.
That was a weird episode.
It was very weird. It was very weird.
Yeah.
Very strange. Even though it had Twiggy in it more than we've seen all season.
Oh, we had Beady 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 back. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Blank. That part I really liked.
Yeah.
Because they were like buddies again.
Mm-hmm.
He went on the mission with Twiggy.
Yeah, he took Twiggy. Even though...
He didn't take Hawk. It seems like Hawk and Wilma, sometimes they don't do nothing. Or they're off, like, they get paid to come to the episode and just show their face.
Right. Yeah, they didn't do much other than go on a mission until Asimov told them to come back because they needed to go rescue Buck. And so they came back, but they didn't. They just left the ship and then came back. That was about it.
Yeah.
But Twiggy didn't really have any wisecracks or silly lines or anything like that, but
No, but the camaraderie or seemed that it was still there.
yeah, he chose to take Twiggy with him, and he is his buddy, and he was a part of the episode, definitely biggest part of an episode he's been since the last season. But it was strange that it had to do a lot with mythology.
Yeah.
Or a mythological creature, at least.
The way it happened was weird. I mean, well, he was going to this planet while Wilma and Hawk were gonna, I guess, scout some asteroids. I don't know, or navigate the asteroid field so they could go through. I don't know what they were doing.
No, it was something like that. And I don't think it's important to I don't think it mattered beyond that. It was just the fact that they were doing something else,
They were doing something else,
and they didn't really focus on it.
yeah, except they called them back when they later on in the episode.
Yeah.
But he goes down to what is he to catalog this colony that's down there? Dr.
Yeah.
Goodfellow wants him to go down there, and he tells him about this one major. I forget what his name was. Do you know what his name was?
Major
Samos,
Samos,
John Stamos.
something like that, yeah. Yeah. And then and he finds him, and he's living in a house with two other guys, and the one guy's three daughters or four daughters. No, three
Was
daughters.
a full house. No, this the full house only had a woman and her son.
No, it wasn't. It was a not full house.
It was not a full house. It was a part house, and they seemed to live in the house all by themselves, and live off the land. They had their own farm, and they were haunted by this satyr, which is a half goat, half man, who was always playing the flute. He was always playing one of those mythical flutes. But
Yeah.
he would like haunt them, but I actually thought something bad was gonna happen when he threw the son out of the house and the woman was still in there. But he just seemed to like just raid the food. That's like what he came for. He'd like raid the food, but he wouldn't, other than throwing them around and kind of like some physical abuse, he wouldn't kill him or anything, or harm him beyond that. And
Right. I wonder if they were meaning to imply it a little bit, though.
like what you thought when they first closed the door?
Yeah, just
I
because of
thought he was
how.
gonna rape her is what I
Right,
thought.
that's what I mean. I wonder if they wanted to imply it, but just subtly because of the audience it was directed at. They didn't want to really.
Yeah.
I thought that at the same time as you did, and then I thought, oh, maybe not. And then the only thing that made me think it again later on was just how there was a focus
On the women and the
on the
wine.
women, and it wasn't just the wine and the
Yeah.
fact that he had laid claim to the woman. And she made a comment at some point later on that I forget what it was, but just had some sort of, had a little bit of an implication to it. But either way, even without that, the satyr is terrorizing them. But they don't seem interested in leaving, or at least she doesn't, and it's not really clear why at first. But the kid is very interested in Buck and interested in his dad's history. He has his dad's notes and books and stuff like that, and he's been studying them and seems really interested in doing the same thing that his dad did. And he definitely gets a kick out of Twiggy, and Buck starts showing him some of the stuff about Buck's ship that he used to get to the planet. And when Twiggy gets hurt. He gets the kid's really interested in watching Buck fix Twiggy and stuff. Because one of the things that the setter has is this electric whip sort of thing, where it's a whip, but it also has an electrical charge on it. And that's one thing that I never really was, unless I missed something, I was never really clear on how
It
this.
looked like it when it snapped, it threw an electrical bolt because it went
Right.
like a really long distance. Plus, the satyr had this really cool horse, which looked like a machine
Yeah.
horse, like that was blowing steam out of its face.
Yeah, and that was the one thing that wasn't really cleared up for me unless I missed something, was when you find out later where the satyrs are coming from, it wasn't real clear to me, well, where the hell did they get this mechanical horse and where did these electrical whips come from? Because like you said, it's not just electrified, like I said, it actually throws the electrical bolt. And that's how Twiggy gets hurt, is he gets hit by one of the bolts.
Yeah, it's a pretty good laser fight. Like Buck is on the ground shooting his laser, and he's like trying to whip him with the whip. And
Yeah.
he gets before that actually happens, how he gets introduced by to the boy is he gets attacked by some kind of like wolf, and he gets bit, and the boy takes him to get fixed by his mom. He says, "We'll give you a meal and we'll fix up your wound." And Buck takes him up on that. And during this whole conversation, there's like little clues like why Buck is like curious why they're living there by themselves and where all the people were.
Yeah.
And you kind of learn later on what happens to at least the men.
Right. Yeah, and the major's wife, she's not, you'd think that if they're the only two people on this planet left, it's curious that they didn't leave as well, but Buck and the audience is, I would think, surprised to see that she's not interested in leaving. And Buck doesn't really get that. Buck ends up getting in a fight with the Satyr where they're in this pond sort of thing. And Buck's in the water and the Satyr uses its whip at the water, and obviously it has electrical charge to it, so that's not a good idea. Wouldn't that have also charged? Wouldn't the electrical current have gone through the water as well, or is my science bad? Because I know it goes back and
Yeah.
it takes out the Satyr because he's holding the whip, but Buck's in
Buck,
the water at the
Buck,
time, so.
yeah, but he was pretty far away at that time.
Oh, okay.
He seemed like he was at least 12 feet away
Gotcha.
when he hit the whip. Every time he threw the whip, it seemed like he was really far away. Like
Yeah.
there were the special effects guys were like, "We don't want you whipping Buck."
No whip in the
Yeah, don't whip the star.
star.
But it's a pretty cool fight because they fight in the water, and he you think he drowns the satyr. He like sticks
Right.
his head under the water, and you think he's dead. But you see, as soon as Buck walks away, you see the satyr pull himself out of the water. But the satyr
Yeah.
bites Buck, and then Buck goes back to the farmhouse to be healed. And over time, his eyes start to glow because the satyr always has like these glowing yellow eyes. And that's the first sign that you know he's infected, is Buck's eyes start to glow.
Yeah. And it's a pretty bad bite too.
It's like twice as worse as the wolf.
Yeah. And this is where we find out, because we see that Buck is turning from getting bit by a satyr, this is where we find out, I think, that the satyr that's been bothering them is actually the major, that him and other colonists on the planet, they were they were turned. The men started to get turned as they got bit, and a lot of people voted to leave, but the major was really committed to his project. He was the one that found the planet and thought it was hospitable and a good place for a colony. So that explains as well why his wife doesn't want to leave, because she and why she tolerates the Satyr, or and does some things to help it, even though it's causing a lot of problems for them. It's because it's her husband, and she still really wants to try to. She doesn't want to give up hope. She doesn't want to leave him there.
And she does explain to Buck how there's other satyrs there.
Right.
It's just that this satyr, they're very territorial, I guess.
Yeah.
And they have their own like areas where they have their whatever they do, but their protection zones or their territories.
Yeah, they're very territorial.
Yeah.
And he in particular has seems to be a fairly dominant satyr. At this point, we now that we know how they're created and that there are other ones, that's where we see a couple other satyrs that aren't named or anything, but they just happen to be two others that come along too. Don't know if something instinctually tells them that the territory might be open, but even though the major is actually still alive, and we've seen that he recovered from, he wasn't actually drowned by Buck.
Maybe it's because he stopped blowing his flute.
Yeah, maybe
Because it
that's how
seemed like
they.
a loud flute.
Yeah. And the flutes, it's not hard to figure out how they would have gotten those, because they can just make those, out of some plants or something like that on the planet.
That's
But I,
also like a mythical thing, isn't it?
yeah,
Like
that's
they
part
always have
of,
that character playing the.
yeah, that's the satyr. That's part of their deal, is that they
Yeah.
have the flute, and you'll see one of the satyr Pan, PAN. A lot of times is specifically mentioned in Pan's flutes and stuff like that. But yeah, I still wonder where they got those whips and he got that horse, but I guess they just looked cool. They're futuristic satyrs. And these
Maybe
two,
the
so
horse was bit too.
yeah. It was bit by another mechanical horse.
But it looked like it looked like more of a mechanical horse than a.
But anyways, those two other satyrs that come along, they steal the kid and take him. And while this is going on, Buck is continuing to turn. He's getting hairier and hairier. It's definitely reminding me of Teen Wolf as he was changing appearance. But he still has his wits about him for the most part.
And the horns, and his voice is changing because their voice turns into like, rawr, rawr, it turns into a bunch of growls.
Yeah, the woman, the
Woman and
wine.
the wine and the woman and the woman and the wine.
Yeah, so Buck starts sounding like that, and we see that the major, he's actually starting to remember something about almost being drowned. I guess he must have been close to dying, sort of a near-death experience. He's actually started to remember who he was, and so he comes back to protect his family from the other two satyrs. And before he does this, Buck and the family are trying to get ready to leave, take off. So they had already wired the place, their house, to blow with a bunch of
That's pretty cool because they know they're gonna go to the wine, right? So they rig where the wine is.
yeah
They put the dynamite by the wine.
right yeah because that's what the woman spends a lot of her time doing is harvesting grapes and making wine.
And it was a lot of wine. There was like
It was a lot, yeah.
there was like 4 or 5 barrels in there.
Yeah.
With there were taps on them too.
Right. So.
They were picking grapes though at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, one of the first things that we see the satyr do is come in and like, "Where's the wine? I want wine. I'm thirsty." And she's like, "You drank it all yesterday. I haven't been able to make any more yet." Like, didn't you already get enough badges checking in on your
They
app?
had a red-headed satyr too. One of
Yeah.
the They don't
So,
like each other either. They fight.
no,
The two
yeah.
satyrs. They're always fighting.
Yeah, that's how Buck's able to get the kid back, is because they end up fighting, the two that kidnapped him end up fighting each other. And so Buck's able to get the kid away while they're distracted by fighting each other. But basically the major ends up, he has a moment with his wife where they're able to speak to each other again, and he's able to apologize to her and say that he feels bad for everything that he's done. He never meant to hurt them. And then before she can stop him, basically he sacrifices himself to destroy the other satyrs and allow his wife and Buck and the kid to escape. And back on the searcher, Crichton is able to heal Buck by researching the infection that causes the change and creating an antidote for Buck.
It's kind of cool though, because he says you have to catch it within a certain time or you're screwed.
Yeah, it
So
was still
they
early
couldn't
enough.
rescue those people. They couldn't rescue the other satyrs. They were
Yeah,
already
that's true.
gone. Yeah.
Good covering themselves there, that they story-wise that they
There was a
didn't
little flirting
die in a
between
storm.
Wilma and Buck this episode though, with the moonlight. Or did I not catch that phrase right?
Yeah, there was a joke at the beginning. Buck made a joke to Wilma about, you shouldn't come on this mission because the planet has three moons and we all know what happens to you in moonlight.
Yeah.
And then she made the joke back to him at the end. But yeah, it's not really heavily done, but it seems like rather than have Buck with all these different ladies all the time, they're doing more of like a romantic tension between the two of them this season. Maybe
Yeah.
if the show continued, they probably would have kept increasing that. But I thought it was kind of cool that the kid, they followed up on the kid and how he was really interested in his in what Buck was doing and what his father had done, that they said that they were and he was getting enrolled in the Cadet Academy.
Starfleet Academy.
Yeah. So
I thought the kid was a better actor than the Golden Boy too.
yeah, I think he was a better actor than the actress that played his mom, and
Oh
so I was sorry
yeah.
to say, but I didn't really wasn't very impressed with her. I
Overall,
mean,
I thought it was a long, drawn out episode. Like some of the concepts were cool, but it just like was long. It took forever.
Yeah, it wasn't the worst episode, but
Oh no, I think the worst one was the God, I can't remember what it was called, but the one that we both didn't like.
yeah, that's liable to be the worst. I mean, but who knows?
Don't think we'll get worse than that
We
one.
got some left, but so far this season has been watchable.
Yeah.
So, did you? We kind of jumped right into Buck, but I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to mention for the show from your Denver Comic Con experience.
I just completed my DC Comics Presents finally. I did that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I was
Yeah.
talking about that.
And I bought a lot of Helix titles, which was a sci-fi attempt by DC to make a new Vertigo line. back in the day. And I think I got most of them except for one title. I'm missing a few of them. But what else did I complete? I completed my Warlord annuals. I was missing a few annuals. I got those. I think that's about it. I bought a lot of Helix. It has a few odds and ends, but I didn't buy a lot of comics because I bought a lot of art. I bought two Ninjak sketches, one, let me see, what else? Well, I got two Ninjaks and one, God, I can't even think of it now. Ah.
I'm
Oh,
trying to remember.
Rai. I got a Rai.
Okay.
And then I got a Wonder Woman sketch too, which I like Wonder Woman a lot. And there's an artist, Michael Dooney, who does a lot of Wonder Woman stuff. And I bought a print from him many years ago, and this time I got an original, so.
Cool. The night before the con, that was actually at Mile
Mile
High
High.
Comics, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that they've done
That's
previous
something
years
that
too.
they've done, yeah, always the day before the con starts. And they have like all kinds of sales. I got a really cool Flash Captain Cold statue. I don't know if you got to see that. But it
Yeah, I
has like
did. I bet.
Captain Cold blasting his gun and Flash is kind of like running. It's
Yeah,
a
that's
pretty
awesome.
cool statue. And I got a Booster Gold statue. They
Yeah,
had some good
that's right.
prices. It was like you spend this much, you get 30. If you spend this much, you get 40%. And if you spend this much, you get 50.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
'Cause I don't think they do a lot of sales, at least not online, right? On their store.
Yeah, they don't. I don't use. I usually go to mycomicshop.com just because I get better deals there. But they had some good deals for this Comic Con. Even at their booth at the at Denver Comic Con was all 50% off.
That's cool.
So yeah, it turned out good because I like priced around a couple of vendors to get the books that I was missing. Because I know I read DC Comics Presents number one, but I don't have it. So I don't know if it's a comic book that I traded away or I lost or something. But that was like a book that was kind of pricey. I think the most pricey one is the one you have, the one with Superboy, the Crisis one that has Superboy Prime. That's probably like the most expensive one. But yeah, I completed those, which is cool. And I got decent prices for them, so I was pretty happy.
That's cool.
I
Are
bought
they
a lot of
located?
t-shirts, a lot of Valiant t-shirts.
Yeah, it's definitely a Valiant themed con for you, it looked like.
Yeah, I got a lot of swag.
That's
Bought four
cool.
t-shirts, a Bloodshot, a Ninjak, a Valiant 25th anniversary, and I can't think what the other shirt is. Bloodshot, Ninjak. There was no XO. The 25th anniversary. I can't think of the other one. Son of a bitch. I'm getting old, man. I don't remember anything. Which one? Oh, thank you, Barb remembered. God damn it. It was Divinity. Which is an interesting shirt because it does get a lot of looks because it, I don't know, Divinity could have a lot of connotation, right? When you read
That's
the
true.
word, like religious.
Right.
So
People, yeah.
it's an interesting shirt because it's got like Divinity, just the words in the front. But then it's got the cover to issue one on the back. So a lot of people do look at it like think, what is this guy, a religious guy or what? They look at the back and it's got like this sci-fi godlike guy in space.
That's all right. Just creates more mystery about you too.
Yeah.
Keep them guessing. Denver, that seems like that con's gotten pretty big.
Yeah, it was really crowded. Oh, and the other retro, we did a retro thing. We went to go see the Weird Science panel, which was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, that's right. And you got your picture taken with
With Kelly LeBrock,
yeah.
which I used to be in love with back in the day. Not as much as Erin Gray, and Erin Gray did age better. Erin Gray is still amazing looking. Kelly LeBrock looks a little bit. Because she has those big lips. Like they're big lips. Now she's just much older. But she was cool. I got my picture taken with Kelly LeBrock, which my favorite movie is not Weird Science with her, it's The Woman in Red.
Yeah.
Which is with Gene Wilder. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
Yeah.
I love that movie for some reason because it's about like four buddies and this one guy's having an affair or he just falls in love with the Kelly LeBrock character and decides to have a one night thing with her and it turns into a disaster. But it's an interesting movie. I like that movie a lot. So yeah, I talked to her about that movie and the Weird Science one was cool because of Michael Anthony Hall. I keep on saying Anthony Michael Hall. It is Anthony Michael Hall.
It is, I
I
was going to
keep getting
say,
the fucking Van Halen guy confused with his name.
oh, Michael
Michael Anthony
Anthony.
and Anthony Michael Hall. Michael Anthony's the Van Halen
Right.
bass player. And Anthony
Oh,
Michael Hall was in 16 Candles. He was in Vacation with Chevy Chase. He was the first Rusty.
right.
He's in Weird Science. He's been in a lot of John Hughes films.
Yeah.
And my favorite was probably Pretty in Pink. Oh, he's in The Breakfast Club too. That's another big
Right.
one that he's been in.
Yeah. I swear that
I'm
he
not a Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles.
Right.
Pretty in Pink was Andrew McCarthy,
Yeah, and
John Cryer, the Duck Man.
Ducky,
I don't like that movie that much. The more I watch that
Really?
movie, the less I like it because I still think the Andrew McCarthy character is a jackass. Like, even though everybody
Yeah.
gets what they want at the end, because it's a story of rich and poor. Like, I guess the Romeo and Juliet, the Capulets, and the Montagues or whatever they.
Yeah,
It's
that's right.
kind of like. Like that, but I don't know. James Spader's in it too, Ultron, so
Oh, right,
he
yeah.
plays the jackass. But yeah, 16 Candles is where she has the birthday, and they have that scene where one thing Molly Ringwald does that's pretty cool to make Farmer Ted cool is she gives Farmer Ted her panties. So Farmer Ted could like show all the freshmen that he got into somebody's pants, and he actually charges admission into the boys' bathroom to get to show the panties. Oh, you want to see the panties? It's a buck. So everybody has to pay a buck to go see the girls' panties. So, Anthony Michael Hall had a pretty good line. 20. I don't know, it was about 20, 25 deep, maybe even longer than that, because it seemed like we're on the edge of the line. And it took us about 25 minutes, I think, if not 30 minutes, to get to where Barb could get her signature and picture with him. And he does look like him. Like you look at him and you could see that he's still Anthony Michael Hall. And he's one thing that it took 30 minutes for us because he was really cool. He wasn't like one of those people that was like next, you know. He actually spent time talking to people, you know, which was really
Right.
cool. But the woman in front of us, man, Jesus Christ, the guy just like dropped her panties right in front of us. Like when we were at the back of the line, like he just took her panties off, and he says, "I'm gonna have him hold these panties." So that was a really weird thing to happen.
Did you happen to see his reaction to?
I took a picture of it. Anthony Michael Hall said these guys were in line originally, and he wanted to take off her panties in front of him. and he said, "No, there's kids in this line. You know, you can't
yeah. take
off her panties." But so they went to the back of the line and dropped their drawers, and then took them to the front.
Jeez. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty insane. But it was a good panel. The guy that played Barb, who was the whiny guy? Wyatt. Because I remember Kelly LeBrock used to always say Wyatt. She had this really heavy accent. And he seemed really cool. He didn't really do much after Weird Science.
Right. But,
he's a teacher. He's actually a college professor. But okay. his voice is definitely the same, like, puberty voice. he definitely has that voice. It's mm-hmm. But Weird Science was a pretty cool movie that I've seen a gazillion times. It's about two teenagers that make a woman. Mm-hmm. And she has magical powers, so she makes them cool. She makes geeky guys cool.
That's what technology will do.
Yeah, it also had Bill Paxton in that movie, but he wasn't at this panel. Bill mm-hmm. Paxton was the older brother that was a jackass.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of... That was cool to see Barb's pictures with Anthony Michael Hall and stuff.
Yeah.
See, I mean, I can tell that it's him, but...
It's a panel, too, yeah. He's filled out a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, it's...
But he's not, like, fat.
No.
Farmer Ted was a scrawny motherfucker. Like, when he was in those movies, he was skinny, like, mm-hmm. really skinny. Now he's filled out. Well, he was in that USA show, The Dead Zone, for a long time.
Yep. Yeah, it just makes you realize when he was in those movies, he definitely had he still had his child body.
Yeah.
Because
he was in a Batman movie, too, just recently. He was one of the... It was the Batman The Dark Knight.
The voice. Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah, it looked like a fun time. I know that you posted about questions, but when I saw your post, it didn't have anything on it. I didn't know if...
I don't think I got any.
You got any, yeah.
No.
Lazy bastards.
I got one on Twitter. It was from Kyle Pettit. It's very much similar to the last question we had. Last week we answered what was our favorite incarnation of the Teen Titans. This one he's asking, what is our favorite incarnation of the Justice League?
I think that one's a little tougher than...
I know what mine is.
Question.
Mine is the Satellite Area Justice League in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
When they had Hawkman, Elongated Man, and all that. I like that roster because it wasn't like a... It wasn't like a big... They had a lot of B-list and C-list characters in there that I liked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite era, but...
Yeah, I could see saying that.
I know
one.
A lot of people will say the funny era with the Bwahaha, but
oh, right.
It wasn't
yeah.
my. Matt, when I first read that stuff, I was in shock. It took me a while to love it because mm-hmm. It didn't seem like the Justice League. Do you know what I mean? It seemed like they spent more time goofing around than they did get anything done.
Oh, yeah, it was very different.
But it grew on me, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So satellite era is definitely a potential answer. I guess for something different, I'll go with the Grant Morrison JLA when they returned from many years of the run from the Bwahaha
That's
that started with that at least.
that's a good era. I didn't think of that, but
I'll
and
say
it,
that because
w it was
it's.
a grand it was a different Grant Morrison too, because I understood those stories. Like, I didn't have to like read too much into it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he
It really
played pretty
felt like a
straight to.
Justice League book.
Right, that's definitely up there with the more straightforward Grant Morrison stories, knowing that he was writing to a very big audience. But I would say one of the things that appealed to me about that is that you had a return to the quote unquote Big Seven, but you had legacy characters in the mix. So, obviously it appeals to me that it's the Wally West Flash, but even though he had been on Justice League teams prior to that, like Justice League Europe and stuff, I think it was really cool in legitimizing for him as the Flash to have him be the Flash on a Justice League with a lineup very similar to the original. And also for Kyle Rayner too, to have him be the Green Lantern on the team. So I liked, and that lineup ended up, it didn't take too long for that to change. Oh, and also another thing I really like that was cool is that I thought it was a really good use of putting Plastic Man on that team too later on. I think it was cool.
Oh,
So.
some I loved it because they like introduced like Plastic Man's kid. They like showed how powerful he really was. Like he's almost like immortal, because do you remember they disintegrated him and then all his parts came back together? I absolutely love what they did with Plastic Man. And then there was that one scene with Wonder Woman that was so hilarious, where he pretended to be her undergarment. I just love that scene. Yeah,
Yeah, they.
he kicked ass with Plastic Man, 'cause I'm a Plastic Man fan, and I want to see like more Plastic Man, but we hardly ever see him. And I would love to for them to keep him in like the Justice League lineup.
I believe Grant Morrison is a big Plastic Man fan, so he,
He's a Golden Age. That's what his thing is Golden
it's
Age
Silver Age.
characters.
I know that one thing that was cool about that was how he managed to show that you can use Plastic Man for both humorous and not just humorous things, he
Exactly.
can do really badass stuff, and that was something that he showed. And you don't see that a lot. I know one other place that you saw that was All-Star Squadron. When Roy Thomas would use Plastic Man, he would show that he would show the badass side of Plastic Man also.
Yeah.
Because I think in the I know in the first All-Star Squadron story, he does some Plastic Man does some really awesome stuff.
Yeah.
But so yeah, I thought that was cool.
I like the Detroit era too, but I know a lot of people shit on that, but I thought it was cool. I like when they revamp the lineups. Like, I don't need the big ones there.
No, I think I prefer
I
to
think he
return
kicked.
to it once in a while, but
Yeah, yeah.
not always have it and change it up. I'm like that with the Avengers too. I like to have the lineup change, have a couple storylines and then have a couple characters leave and bring in a couple of new characters in and just see things change and evolve over time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't I mean, it's. I don't think it'll probably ever be my favorite era, but I've never. I mean, I wasn't reading at the time, but I've never had retroactively a problem with the Detroit era, because I guess because I don't have a problem with like B-list or C-list characters. I find them interesting.
Yeah. This is
So.
another run I need to start focusing on because I have a lot of, I don't have a lot of holes, but I'm missing quite a bit in the 70s. Especially those 100-page giants, and those aren't cheap.
Of the first.
100-page giants are expensive, you know.
Yeah.
They're even having a back issue special that's coming out soon about the 100-page giants.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jerry Conway doing a lot of the Justice League title with Dick Dillon in the Satellite era.
Yeah, he was on the book for a long time.
Yeah. They even have the George Perez ones, which they collected in hardcover. I think there's a volume one and a volume two. So I like have every issue from, let's see, from like 144 on. And then I have like a handful of issues I'm missing in there, maybe less than 10. But then I have this huge gap, and I know why I have the gap. It's because they're expensive. But the 100-page giants, which run like from 110 to 116, and they have a lot of reprints. It just those 100-page giants with the binding to get them in a decent condition. Because they have that square bound look to them, you know, those comics.
Yeah.
They're expensive. And they're just a bunch of reprints. That's what. That's why I probably avoided them, too. But my oldest Justice League is number 5.
That's pretty old.
Yeah. Number 5 and 10.
So you want to get into some comics?
Yeah, let's do that.
Alrighty. Who's gonna start?
I'll start.
Okay.
But I only read 3 books retro this. I haven't read a lot of comics because of all the cons and all the work I've been doing, but I took with me to the con, I took 2 number zeros. One of them was a number zero that I read out of order because it wasn't the first issue. And then one of them was one of the first issues. And it's from, I talked about this in the last episode, Future Comics, which is something I just finished. I had read Death Mask. And I was like, man, these are cool. They have it for people that are Valiant fans or, let's see, Defiant or Broadway fans, they should really seek out the Future Comics, which was formed by Bob Layton and David Michelinie. And it has like Dick Giordano art, you know, like some of the big names.
Yeah.
They tried to go against the grain and form a company where they would deal directly with subscribers and deal directly with shops. In other words, they were trying to, I guess Bob Layton and them, like I read some articles in the back of the Future Comics, but it seemed like they, at the time, these creators felt that Diamond was unjust, was not just. And one of the things that they said in the article was, I get, this was towards the, I think the downfall of comics, maybe when they were recouping from the 90s, you know, because of the speculator market and everything, is he really hated the fact that what he thought is that people would buy Wizard magazine and previews and not necessarily buy the magazines, the actual comic books, because people could follow the solicitations and know more or less what was going on, or follow Wizard magazine and read the articles and not know what's going on. And it seemed like they had like a – didn't like their monopoly on the comic book market. So they said, oh, let's try to shift that over. So they created like a handful of titles, Metallics, Free Mind, Death Mask. And They weren't successful, unfortunately. But you know, if you go against Disney or something, you're not going to probably
Right.
be successful. That's what Diamond is. And I'm a fan of Diamond. I love reading previews. It's like a Christmas catalog every month. But I read I guess I'll start with Free Mind number 0. This was like the first issue. It was co-plotted by David Michelinie and scripted by David Michelinie. The other co-plotter was Bob Layton, and it was inked by Bob Layton, and it was penciled by Jick Giordano. So big names, at least for people that collected comics in the 90s and 80s. These are big names. Free Mind number 0, you think you'd get like a better feel for this character. And I really didn't. It felt like another Death Mask issue, which is kind of cool because Death Mask is like a guy with powers that's like a Punisher, that goes after this evil corporation, and that's what this story involves. Is Free Mind gets caught up in this what is it, like an arms shipment thing, and it happens to be for that corporation that Death Mask is trying to take out. I know this because I've read the entire Death Mask. There's only like 4 issues. And it's pretty much a Death Mask issue. It shows Death Mask going after him and Free Mind actually kind of like hero fighting hero kind of thing. It's like the Spider-Man versus Punisher sort of thing. But the art is really nice, and there's not a lot that I learned from Free Mind, and I haven't read any Free Mind, so I was kind of disappointed that I didn't learn a lot of the corp about that character. But I'm sure that I will find out when Free Mind number 1 comes out next month. But he's got
you
like
have
all
all
kinds
of
of
them, right?
powers. He's kind of a lame suit. He's got like shields, he's got flight. What else does he have? He might have some enhanced strength, but his costume looks a lot like, if you were to look at like the Valiant Hardcore, they have like these generic like corporation suits. That's kind of like what his suit looks like, and he's bald. He looks like a Professor Xavier with like a glowing eye, and he's got an F in one of his chests, on his chest, not in the center of his chest, but on the side, for Free Mind. And this takes place in like Las Vegas, where Death Mask is heavily involved in trying to take out that corporation. So it felt a lot like that kind of issue. It flowed really well for me reading Death Mask. I just didn't learn a lot about that character, but I read Free Mind number 0. I'd recommend these. These are good books, and they're like dirt cheap. You can get them for like $1 or less. especially if you like dead universes and you want to learn more about dead universes. Well, the niche on this one was they tried to go against Diamond for a while and didn't succeed very well. And then they got assimilated by Diamond later on. So they gave in, but
But definitely good creators involved.
yeah.
For sure. And you have all of those at this point, right?
Yeah, that's another universe I just completed just fairly recently.
Right. That's cool. And there's not a lot of those, right? Altogether.
Probably about 20 books total.
Yeah, it didn't last too long.
Yeah. But they did last long enough to get into the Free Comic Book Day. Went like the, I think it was the inaugural year.
Oh, really?
There's a Metallics Free Comic Book Day version, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was that late.
Yeah. I didn't
Apparently.
realize how long Free Comic Book Day's been around.
Yeah, it seems like it hasn't been that long, but Well, I read some more Wonder Woman continuing from last time. I read 313 and 314. And I mentioned last time that there was some subplot stuff about Cersei. So this is another story continuing the theme of Dan Mishkin and Don Heck as the artist. And this story is called the Animal Within. So in the beginning, Wonder Woman's having some issues with her robot plane still not working exactly right after being tampered with by those gremlin creatures. And while that's going on, while she's trying to get it back under control, we see Cersei's her one of her things is that she'll turn men into beasts, and she has a military man called Major Griggs captive, and he's surrounded by a lot of beasts that she's already turned, and so we witness her change him into a ram. And so then
Just like the cover, huh?
the cover is Wonder Woman reacting to seeing this Major Griggs coming at her as a ram, with Cersei in the background with her leopard, which is out of her pets, the one that's like her right hand.
And she looks very different because Cersei, that we know, is usually wearing green. And this one's wearing red with gold jewelry.
Yeah, she's got.
She looks more like a sorceress back.
Yeah, she looks very like a medieval sorceress kind of mythological character. So back at the Pentagon, Steve Trevor is arguing with the general, and they're having a difference opinion about whether this Keith Griggs, who's gone on a mission, sent in solo, and Steve's pissed about it. He's pissed about Griggs even being sent by himself at the first time. Although Etta Candy is there, and her thoughts tell us that she thinks that Steve is just jealous that someone else is being given preferential treatment from the general. So, long story short, they end up deciding to send Diana in to find out what happened to Griggs. And there's this other plot going on where forgetting her name, but this woman that the Amazons have taken in, she's the one that she stole a tape last time that has information about Wonder Woman's past that she feels like Hippolyta is keeping from them. And she's a candidate to become an Amazon, but she's kind of ruining her chances here. And they don't tell you her name again, so it's kind of hard to remember. Usually they'll write it in such a way to drive your memory, but she swims to Science Island to the memory machine to play back the tapes about Wonder Woman's past and this other Amazon, Sophia, her name is. This Amazon, Paula, finds her, and so they get into a bit of a battle, but Sophia gets the upper hand by tricking her and pretending that she's apologizing, but then she kicks Paula in the face. So Sophia, she's trying to research secrets about Wonder Woman's background. There's a pretty cool action sequence where Wonder Woman is flying in as Diana Prince in an actual U.S. Air Force jet. She's piloting it, and she's attacked by this pterodactyl type creature. She ends up having to. She pretty much has to sacrifice the jet because the beast latches on, and so she uses her Amazonian strength to punch a hole in the hull and stretch it out, and she actually jumps out in her
in her pilot uniform, and as she's falling forward, she spins her lasso around herself in midair and turns into Wonder Woman in midair and flies in over the treetops as Wonder Woman. So it's probably really cool, kind of a cool action sequence there. And she pretty much immediately comes up against some of Cersei and some of her beasts, and an ape, and then and a tiger. Back in the Pentagon, that gremlin that showed up, or that came back last time with Steve and Wonder Woman, shows up outside the window and starts tapping on the window while he's talking to the general. But fortunately, Steve's the only one that could see it. So that little guy's still around. And Wonder Woman's battling with the different beasts that Cersei's throwing at her. And then there's a surprising moment for her when it seems that Cersei has some sort of unseen ally, because there's a lightning blast that comes from the sky, and Wonder Woman blocks it by putting her bracelets together and holding it up in front of her face. But the lightning fuses her bracelets together, and that means that she loses her powers, which means that the lightning blast must have come from a man. Because at this time, if a man binds her bracelets together, she loses her Amazonian powers. And the story
That always
ends
seemed
with.
to be her weakness early on, though, too. Like, even
Yeah.
in the when she was bound, she'd lose her powers, which is weird.
It was, yeah.
It's such a weird thing. At least this one's a little more explained. You bind her bracelets, but it has to be a man. That's weird. That's still weird.
Yeah, there's. I mean, that's part of the reason there's been so many books written about Wonder Woman,
Yeah,
and
a lot of sexual thing.
William Marston was an interesting guy because he was a feminist, but then he had this whole thing
Well, he
about
had a harem.
bondage.
He had two girlfriends and a wife, and they all lived
Yeah,
together.
so he was an interesting guy. The Huntress backup kind of somewhat resolves the story with the earthworm dude. It's Joey Cavalieri again, with this time the pencils and inks are by Tim Burgard and Gary Martin. And when we last left off with her, she was surrounded by a mob of vigilante haters on a rooftop, and so she gets away by kind of clever. She gets away by just jumping off of the rooftop, which no one else is willing to do, but she's able to use her abilities with, rappelling and her whip, and not whip, but
Crossbow.
her line. Yeah, well, she connects a line to another building, and
Yeah.
swings like Batman does. And then she uses a batarang to break a water main on the side of a building to hit a lot of the crowd that are around where she lands, and she gets away from that scene. So then she goes after the politician that is involved in this whole child smuggling scheme, and roughs him up to get the location of Earthworm from him. And so then Earthworm is in the sewers with a whole bunch of rats and stuff, and Huntress shows up to surprise him, and he tries to send all his rats at her, but they don't do much. She doesn't have much problem with them. She's able to Earthworm ends up getting away, but she's able to rescue a child that they have. It kind of wraps up the story, but Earthworm managed to get away using this trick sewer grate. But she takes consolation in the fact that she was able to save the child that they have. And then 314, well, it starts a new Huntress story. It continues the Cersei story with Wonder Woman, which is the nature of the beast, is the name of the story. And Wonder Woman, it picks up right up where the last issue ended, where Wonder Woman is having to fight the transformed Major Greggs without trying to take him down without hurting him, because she knows it's her friend. And she's able to, Wonder Woman's able to kind of get through to him a bit, enough to confuse him, so that he second guesses Cersei's commands briefly. Gets him to sort of remember who, and I guess the deal with Cersei is, if you can get the transformed men to least question her commands, it breaks the spell somewhat. But Wonder Woman still has to get away from a leopard and a snake which actually goes after the Major once he's transformed back into himself. There's an interesting scene where Steve Trevor actually seems to kind of hit on Etta Candy. He asks her out to dinner, and she seems pretty excited. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, because it's not clear whether she's misunderstanding him or not. But Wonder Woman's ends up getting trapped by a couple of Cersei's creatures eventually, and she asks her, why have you been making all these unprovoked attacks on me? And it seems that even before I started reading the last couple of issues, that there were other attacks in issues 301, 302, and 305, based on the editor's note that's there. And Cersei tells her that the whole reason that she's doing this is because it's not what she has done to Cersei, but what she's supposed to do. That there's the Oracle foretold that Hippolyta's daughter would be her undoing. So she's trying to avoid the prophecy by taking Wonder Woman out first. But, you know, that never works out well. Wonder Woman gets away, and she sends Greggs off to rescue himself, that she could take care of herself and whatnot. But she's still trying to figure out, Wonder Woman's still trying to figure out who Cersei's ally is, and who's the one that sent the lightning that bound her wrists. And she's starting to wonder if maybe that Cersei is not the lead in the partnership. And there's some more lightning blasts, but this time Wonder Woman is careful not to put her bracelets together when she deflects them. She just uses one bracelet at a time. So there's this interesting sequence where there's this large obsidian mirror that comes out and open, and it gets bigger and bigger, and Cersei looks at it and she's an image of herself as an old woman. She tries to attack the mirror and it swallows her up, and this giant god, and it's an Aztec god, the Jaguar Lord, comes out. Wonder Woman stands up to about his kneecap. That's how tall he is. He says his name. It's one of those Aztec god names. I will most likely mangle. It's something like Tezcatlipoca. Well, that was probably not too bad.
those are they're very hard names to pronounce.
Yeah.
Because I remember reading Grant Morrison's Aztec.
Mm.
And I remember them having a lot of the names, yeah. And they were hard to. They're hard to pronounce.
Yeah, they're crazy, and they're usually crazy long.
Yeah.
But this mirror, it reveals everything. It reveals the truth, or it reveals secrets. So when Wonder Woman looks into it, she sees herself as Diana Prince, and it actually turns her back into Di. But it turns out to be convenient because some other some other Air Force men come reach at this point to help rescue the major. And so Diana meets up with them, and the major says, "Where the hell did you come from?" And she just, you know, says that she flew down to find him when he didn't report in, but it took her a while to find the island. But it seems that Cersei was working for the Aztec god, and he proclaims himself the creator and destroyer of all things, and all this smoke starts to rise up around them, originating out of the mirror, and Diana and Major Greggs and the other Air Force people find themselves all of a sudden in this Aztec place, with all these Aztec warriors around them, and some women that Wonder Woman recognizes as Amazons grab her by the arm and start escorting her to the sacrificial altar. So it's a pretty surprise ending. There's a little bit more with Colonel Trevor and the alien, the little alien, green alien guy that I skipped over, where
Kazoo.
The kazoo looking guy. where he meets up with a Miss Abernathy, and they start talking about the political goings-ons with the senator and all the stuff that's just kind of like seems to be an ongoing B plot. The Huntress Backup starts a new story where it's where the antagonist is this guy named the Sea Lion, where that has a peg leg. There's this Huntress gets called in to help track down some stolen shipments. She's introduced to this Dr. Graham and Dr. Tori. Dr. Graham seems a lot more willing to have her help, whereas this Dr. Tori just kind of gives her the cold shoulder. But later on, this Dr. Tori is trying to key in a password to this secret project that she's working on, and somebody's changed the password, and Huntress shows up and finally convinces her to talk about what's going on. She's working on this Project Starfish that they're trying to figure out how some animals regenerate their limbs after losing them and try to alter the DNA helix of humans so they can do that too. But the data is leaking out to someone, and that someone is patenting their discoveries before they can. So she needs to find out who the leak in the hospital is. So, the art was different on the two different Huntress backups, but they make an interesting counterpart to the Wonder Woman stories, how it's more of a street-level character. But I really like the Don Heck art on the two Wonder Woman issues, and it's definitely that old school storytelling. It's kind of a sweet spot for me, where in the 70s and 80s, where you had pretty modern plots and character development, but you have that older style of storytelling where you have a lot of ongoing, it wasn't written for the trade, it was written for the newsstand, so you have a lot of ongoing plots that keep flowing along. Like, you might have one that starts up and stops, but then you have like the political Steve Trevor stuff that just kind of keeps going in the background and stuff, so it keeps you reading.
It's my favorite time of storytelling because of the way they tell the story, because they tell the story for almost like you can jump on at any time, but you have all these plot lines that keep you interested that you want to come back.
Right.
And we don't have that anymore. Now it's more like written for the trade. At least the majority of stuff is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal, really, It's like,
for comic books, at least when you
back
at
then
least when
it
they
was
were
totally a
accessible.
monthly yeah it was totally a monthly thing.
Yeah,
now they're writing for trades and they're writing for movies and like plot, you know, like whole storylines. And then it was like, let's just get the guy who's buying the monthly to come back next week.
Yeah. And it has made a huge difference. I think that less and less people are, as less and less people are picking up their stuff on the newsstands, you know, because when they were, it was really good for them to have people be able to, like you said, get in on any issue. But then ideally you want somebody to be able to pick up any issue and get hooked. But, and then you want them to keep reading, you know?
Yeah.
Now that they know about the title, you want them to keep showing up and picking it up, making a point to try to get there to the, wherever they buy their comics.
Right. Well,
yeah.
My next issue is also in Future Comics. It's Metallics number 0. And this one did feel more like an issue 0. This was, although it wasn't the first issue, because they have an ad for it, like Metallics number 6. Has a big ad in the back, too. If you're a comics retailer, you need to call this number toll free. For deeper discounts, superior and personal customer service, and a direct line to Future Comics. The other thing that it says, beginning in July, all Future Comics were 100% returnable.
Wow.
If you order directly from us. So this is probably when they were also solicited in Diamond, but you could go directly to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is The Origin of Metallics, Part 1. It's got like 4 parts in this story that tell the origin of him. And it's the comic's first tag team superhero. At least that's what they call themselves on the front of the cover. And it opens up with in California, there's this guy testing this Metallics armor, and they're like bombarding it with massive amounts of heat. And he's using Metal X, which is the metal that they came up with, and they're just bombing it. And the guy that's running the suit, or in the suit, his name is Max. And he's like, keep pushing it, you know, keep pushing the limit on the heat, you know, so we could learn the limitations. But the guy that owns the company, Owen Parrish, he's like, no, shut it down. He doesn't want to risk anything to hurt his employees. And then he gets pissed and leaves, that Max guy. And he's got like an assistant that's always with him, Mr. Parrish. He's his name is Stu Koenig. And they own a business. They're developing this armor for defensive purposes, like rescue recovery and stuff like that, so you could take extreme amounts of heat and all that stuff. And meanwhile, his corporation is going he's actually flying his helicopter with Stu to meet these various adventurers. And they're very strange. Like, this one guy's doing a sensor studies in the middle of a volcano, and he shows up there. He says, I'm Owen Parrish, and I'm with an organization. I want to make a proposal to you. And it looks like he's recruiting people. And then Max is back in Los Angeles, and you learn that this guy's a real asshole, like really bad. Like, he has this girlfriend, and he's really abusive to her. Like, he like will blow his top. Like, if she's like really accommodating, like, can I get you this? Can I get you that? And he just gets frustrated, and he's really frustrated about like how the corporation's not allowing him to do what he wants with the armor and stuff. He's also one of the inventors of the armor, so he's vested in it, but he's really pissed, and he's trying to open up like a jar of jelly, and he's getting really pissed. And his girlfriend says, "Well, try turning it counterclockwise, sweetie." And he just flips out.
Jeez.
But he's like, you learn that he's a really angry person. And then Stu comes in, and he's giving him information from like a research group about their armors, and it has to do with another slimy CEO that they don't want to deal with. But one of the investigators that is doing private files on the armor and is finding out that they're incorporating offensive weapon systems into the Metallics' armor, and you know, without their knowing about it. So they were like a defensive mechanism, and somebody's sabotaging their invention, and they're coming to the bottom of it, and they pretty much want to fire this Max guy, so they pretty much fire him. And he takes it out on his girlfriend. Like, his girlfriend says, "I made reservations for us tonight at Darwin's." And he says, "Darwin's? I'd rather graze at a dumpster. Last week I had to send Stroganoff back 3 times, and they didn't even cut my check. Can't you do anything right?" So he's, like, always yelling at her. And then there's another side. He's an angry dude.
I'm just thinking that the next time my wife asks me if I want to go out to eat somewhere, I'd rather eat out of a dumpster.
I have to send my meal back, my seitan back 3 times. They undercooked my soy.
See, that's one thing I don't have to worry about. I don't have to worry about
any kind of undercooked sickness.
Yeah.
But even with that stuff, you could still get list like stuff through them, like if it's in the food, right? Because
there's stuff like they've been recalling hummus occasionally for listeria or whatever it is.
Yeah,
I think that's ultimately the amount of hummus I go through in a given week. That's probably what I'll die from.
It's like that Def Leppard song, "Listeria." When Listeria. You're here.
Mash up some chickpeas. I eat so much hummus, but I've been lazy last 2 weeks. But I did start making some of my own hummus because it's super easy to make, and then there's probably less chance of recall.
If you fucking up your own garden.
Yeah. So.
Stu and Parrish are going underwater next in the Gulf of Mexico, and they recruit a female named Blue Hill who's doing sound testing with sound waves and aquatics with animals, and he says, "I have a proposition to make to you." And later at the Redstone Research Board meeting, they talk about them firing Dr. Chrome. And he's just totally flipped out, man. He's an angry dude. His girlfriend or wife finally decides to leave him, like, which is the probably right choice.
Mm-hmm.
There's more scenes there where he's doing his anger management stuff and going ballistic. So one of the things that they do when they fire him is they change all the keys, the electronic key codes, to get into the buildings and stuff so that Maxwell Chrome cannot get back in. And they recruit yet another guy that's doing as a helicopter pilot. It's almost like they're recruiting like challengers of the unknown. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like heroes that are adventurers and scientists.
Yeah.
And to be the host of this Metallics armor. But Max decides to break in as a janitor and actually gets the Metallics armor. But Parrish was smart enough to know that he was going to do that, and he uses some tech to deactivate the armor as soon as he starts to destroy the labs. So he did a good job there. And then they form this team, and it's basically 4 adventurers that are going to don this Metallics armor. And I see what they mean by tag teaming it. Like, one guy will tag team with the other, or like slap hands, and the other guy becomes Metallics. So it's pretty interesting. And one of the things that happens is somebody tried to sabotage one of the rooms that they were in. Max was going to kill them all. And you could see that these adventurers were smart enough to get their way out of there. And they form Metallics, and that's how they became the team. So, yeah, it was a pretty cool story. I dug it. It was a good first issue. Unlike the Free Mind Zero, which was really more of the other character than it was a Free Mind. Even though I enjoyed it a lot, this was by far the better issue, at least I thought so. But this one, I don't even think I said the creative team on this one. This one is by Michelini, does the story and the plot, and Ron Lim does the art with Brett Breeding on inks.
That's so cool.
You've talked about Ron Lim in the past with your Infinity Gauntlets and Silver Surfer.
Silver Surfer, yeah. He did Captain America for a while there, too.
Yeah, he did a lot of Kyle Green Lantern, too. He was big back in the day, Ron Lim.
Yeah, I still like his art for sure.
Yeah, so he did the Metallics number zero.
That's cool. Nice. Yeah, they... If nothing else, they got some good, talented creators to work on their with their stuff.
Yeah, it was a very short-lived company, but it was an interesting one.
I think there still are people that feel that way about Diamond. It's just
they it's can't. Hard to, yeah,
it's hard to challenge a monopoly in a business that is small, you know.
Well, I know that Zenoscope must do something similar to what Future Comics does, because my retailer, or not, I use DCBS, but I go to a comic shop, still get some of my DCs from there. And I know he deals with Zenoscope directly, and they ship him directly, not through Diamond, and he gets like really big discounts.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's cool that you're doing some non-Big Two stuff, because I'm still on my DC kick. But
that's where I'm usually at.
Right. So it works out good. I did a couple more Superman, but these are not not a continuation of the issue I talked about last time. These are a little earlier on. These are issues 308 or 307 and 308. And 307 was actually speaking of Jerry Conway. Both these issues were written by Jerry Conway. What got me to pick 307 and start with that one was the cover, which has. You just see Supergirl's legs in the foreground, and at her feet is the Bottle City of Kandor smashed on the ground. And it's one of those surprise covers where a character's like freaking out about something that they were always doing.
It is a great cover. It's like, is it Neil Adams?
Yeah, it looks like a signature, doesn't it?
Let me verify that. Ooh, yeah, Jose Garcia Lopez on art.
Yeah, yeah. The interior is definitely him.
Yeah, it's a Neil Adams cover. It's nice. Pretty distinctive.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's pretty unique on it is, at least my interpretation of what's happening is, it looks like Supergirl, just the way she has her hands.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like she flung it, like threw it down.
Mm-hmm.
And destroyed it.
Yeah, Superman says, "Supergirl, have you gone mad? You've smashed the Bottle City of Kandor and killed 7 million people." So that was enough to draw me in and want to know what's going on there. It's the story's called Krypton No More, and it's one of those stories that starts off in an action sequence. You don't really, then you have to kind of piece together what's going on, where Superman is smashing up this plant, as in like a, as an industrial plant, not a, not what I eat. And this character called the Protector, not the one from the Teen Titans drug awareness special, but this guy that kind of looks like a Kree warrior, but he's all white, and then on his breastplate he has like a yellow sword that's on fire, and he flies, and he has this yellow aura around him. And so his deal is that he's protecting this industrial plant and trying to stop Superman from destroying it. So they battle that out a bit, and the Protector actually manages to blast Superman with a ray, after informing Superman that he's a mutant. Superman's not hurt, but he gets blasted out of the area, and so then we have a flashback that fills us in what was going on, that Clark Kent was at Galaxy Broadcast, and a little bit after the 6 o'clock news, this stranger comes in, and he gives Kent a lead, basically, that the company that he works with knows that this vinyl chloride that they're working with can cause cancer, but and they know that it's affecting their employees, but they're not doing anything. They're not even giving special benefits or instituting any safety standards or anything like that. And Kent asks him, "Well, do you want me to report about this?" And the guy says, "I don't really know what I want you to do, but I just feel like these workers, these coworkers of mine, they deserve a chance to, to know what they were getting into by working here." So Kent suggests, "Why don't I have a neutral party over to look around? Someone like Superman." And then this is when there's that girl, Terry, that was in love with Clark Kent and always following him around and hitting on him. So she shows up, and so does Lois, and Lois was about to offer to cook him dinner, and she sees that Terry is hanging on Clark's arm and calling him Clarky Poo. And so Lois gets pissed, and Clark is just confused, doesn't know exactly. It's like, "Miss Cross, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? What could a young girl like you possibly see?
Stop it some more."
That's, he said, do you, Terry? And he's thinking to himself, "Do you, Terry? You call me a man, but I'm really a native of a planet called Krypton. And much as I like you, we can never be anything to each other, any more than Lois and I. I'm an alien, an outcast, a loner, and that's the way it must remain." So that's how Superman's feeling at the time, that the fact that he's an alien separates himself from the humanity around him.
Very, very, very different than what it is now, where he wants to be more human.
Right. Yeah. And he wants to date everybody.
Yeah.
But, so what got us to the situation at the beginning of the story is that Superman shows up at this place called Metro Chemical, and he asks for a tour. And the guy that owns the place, he seems like a real wheeler and dealer. He's smoking a cigar, and he's just a fast talker. He says, "You know, well, even though we've gotten some bad press lately, we make $10 million a year, and that's the bottom line." And this other guy that's walking with them is just talking about acceptable risk, and, you know, if some workers get sick, well, you know, that's why they have insurance, and we make plastics here, and let's talk about the difference between danger and socially acceptable danger. And obviously Superman's not having any of that sort of line of thinking. And so he's like, no, people like you are destroying this planet, killing its people, ruining its future, and for what? Profit, greed, some sick illusion called progress. And he slams his fist down on a nearby table and then just flies out through the wall. He just whomp, smashes through one of the nearby walls out into the plant and starts using his heat vision to destroy some of the plant. And so then he gets a hold of himself and flies away, and he sits down kind of near your place. He goes up to the American Rockies and sits on top of one of them. And he just recollects back to Krypton, and it seems that some of his frustration and anger is just what happened to Krypton, and his refusal to be orphaned twice, the refusal to see what happened to Krypton, happened to the planet that is his adopted planet. So he goes on a little bit of a crusade where he flies out into the into an ocean, and he takes all of the sailors off of the ship and transports them to the nearby land. And then he's thinking to himself, we've had three major accidents with these so-called super tankers, giant ships designed to transport oil without the slightest regard to planetary safety. And so he's actually lifting up the super tanker out of the water. I don't know if he's going to, like, throw it into outer space or what he's going to do. But he doesn't get a chance, whatever his plans are, because he gets blasted by that protector guy that turns him into a superconductor and traps him in ice. But so then they end up having another fight with his protectors. A lackey of all these corporations, I guess. The fight ends up going underwater, and the protector escapes by searing a tunnel through the ocean floor. And he decides not to follow him because it was the super tanker that he was trying to do something about in the first place. When he flies back up to the water, Supergirl finally appears, and she's like, hold on a second there, cuz, you're getting a little crazy here. She, you know, tells him, yeah, there's no more planet Krypton, but there never was in the first place. And it's like, what? So she takes him to the Fortress of Solitude. And she said, the trouble really began when you built this place. Your delusion about this supposed planet Krypton, it started there. And this monument to your so-called parents, Jor-El and Lara, it's time for this delusion to end. And she starts smashing, she smashes the statue of Jor-El and Lara to bits with her fists. And he's like, well, how do you explain the bottled city of Kandor? It was reduced inside and stolen from Krypton. She's like, look for yourself, cousin. Those are plastic models, the type of thing any kid could buy from the store. So, and she grabs the bottled city and just throws it, not as dramatically as on the cover, but she does just throw it and let it smash in the ground. And she takes him over to this monitor and tells him, your foster father and my foster father, those are, or as you call them, those are our real fathers. They were scientists who work in an atomic lab, and they both got a lot of doses of radiation. And so when we were born, we had these superpowers. We're actually mutants. So Superman's trying to process this, and the protector shows up, but it turns out to just be a projection of him. They battle it out some more in the end of the story. Superman gets rid of the protector briefly by counteracting the type of chemical that the projectin is constructed of. And then it ends with Superman feeling exhausted emotionally, and starting to buy into the idea that a little bit, but just feeling overall confused about the idea that Krypton has just been an illusion of his mind. So a pretty crazy idea there. And the next issue is just by the same creative team. It's called This Planet Is Mine. And it recaps a bit in the first page. Then it was pretty cool double page spread where Supergirl is continuing her destructive path through the Fortress of Solitude. You know, we've gone over this a dozen times. There never was a planet called Krypton. Just smash, like punching her way through this display, I think, of Krypton itself. It's like, stop it. Stop breaking stuff until you're... I'm certain that you're telling the truth. But this protector guy is still around, still a threat, has collected himself and gotten himself back together. But pretty much just to escape before the two Supergirl and Superman get a chance to go after him. And then sort of interesting panel ends the scene where Supergirl pulls out this little communicator and says, "Supergirl reporting in. I've done all you told me to do, and it seems to be working. I only pray it is the right thing." So,
who is she talking to on the other end?
It doesn't tell you. It just says, "Mysterious goings on. Hey, Supergirl, perhaps everything isn't what it seems after all." So Superman goes back to Metropolis and changes into Clark. And when he goes to his apartment, he finds that Lois is there, and she apologizes for getting mad about Terry and has made him dinner after all. And Clark's thinking to himself, well, I've always resisted the idea of a romance with Lois because I thought of myself as an outsider. But if I'm not, then, you know, maybe that's not holding me back anymore. So he toasts to us and to the future. And that turns out that this protector fellow has a sort of a partner. It's someone that he knows has a past connection to, sort of a similar hero called, well, villain more so, called Radion. And he's got kind of a similar costume. His is all yellow with red trunks and the costume comes up over his hair. And he's a survivor of a nuclear disaster. He just kind of hides out in this place that he's at, and the protector's one of the few people that know where he's at. But he's trying to recruit Radion's help against Superman. And Superman, of course, is still trying to process all this news, but he hears and he's looking at, you know, this Phantom Zone projector. Is this just a lie? Is this a fake? All these Krypton mementos that I have hidden in my apartment closet. Am I just crazy? But then he hears a report on the radio that nuclear power station is being attacked. So he sets his issues aside, goes off to defend it, and not surprisingly, it's Radion that's there. It takes him out, and this is actually, Superman was by kind of close to your neck of the woods, and now he's kind of close to mine. It's a fictional nuclear power plant. Doesn't actually exist here, but it's supposed to be near Niagara Falls.
So you think.
Yeah, I know. Maybe this comic is telling me something.
Conspiracy Maybe I have theories. You yeah. need to go find out.
I know. So Superman and Radion fight it out, and Radion's pretty crazy. He just pretty much wants to create a nuclear fallout and create mutated human beings from nuclear fallout, and that he's kind of control somehow. And so it The battle resolves itself in a bit of a stalemate where Radeon leaves, but Superman's wondering if he just won the round and lost the war as he heads back to the Fortress of Solitude, and he's looking at a memento of Krypton and trying to think about whether he's really Kal-El or Clark Kent. And so, well, I'm tired of thinking about this. It's time for a resolution. And Superman follows the Protector back to the Radeon's base, which is supposed to be a secret from everyone else. And it's pretty clever. Superman figures out an interesting way to defeat the two, because he hasn't had too much luck going head-on against their powers. So he starts using more evasive maneuvers, and he flies around in a circle and then confines space, and Radeon keeps shooting radioactive blasts at him, and he uses his speed and flight to eventually cause Radeon to blast the Protector with his and prior to that, he had tricked the Protector into becoming a reflective surface by shooting his heat vision at him, and Protector protected himself by reflecting the heat beams. And so when he still sort of has that status when Radeon blasts him, and so Protector reflects Radeon's blast back at himself, and the two end up knocked out. Superman's left thinking, do I actually have something in common with these two? They're mutants, and apparently so am I. And then it ends with some shadowy figures in, looks like a spaceship of some sort, monitoring, looking at the monitor in their spaceship. It says, look, my friends, a fleet of space-going warships headed for the planet Zon, X-O-N-N. Once it would have been a job for Superman, but now I am not so sure. And one of the other guys says, true, we have caused him to abandon his Kryptonian heritage. Yet now I wonder, have we doomed a world by so doing? If we have, then we have also doomed ourselves. If Zon falls, can Earth be far behind? So that's how it ends.
Also a Neil Adams cover.
Yeah, and so I got those in Comixology when they were on for sale, and they don't have the next issue.
that's like, probably why. It's probably there were Neil Adams covers.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a two-part story, so.
Kind of, but I still don't know what the hell is going on with Superman thinking he's not from Krypton, so I might have to see how much the next issue goes for and
get
a paper, because, I mean, it's not like, you know.
They're not that expensive.
No.
The Neil Adams covers are always at $5 or $10, depending.
Yeah.
Unless it's a Batman one, then forget it.
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of expensive.
I mean, obviously, you know, I know Superman's actually from Krypton, but I'm curious what the story behind it is, you know, and why Supergirl is involved.
Second cover, not nearly as nice as the first one.
No. No, it doesn't stand out as much, but
yeah. Like the first one, you could look at Superman and kind of know it's Neil Adams.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, not so much.
Yeah. The obviously the art and the inside is really awesome too. Jose Garcia Lopez, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, but you know, the Protector and Radeon, neither of them are all that interesting as villains, but the main, in some ways, the thrust of the story is more with the whole business with his origins and Supergirl. I was definitely very entertained by the visuals of Supergirl just like smashing up his stuff
in the
Fortress of Solitude. And yeah, I'm wondering if there's gonna be some way that they reverse that, because she. Some of the things, you know, obviously with the Bottled City of Kandor and with the statues of Jor-El and Lara, those are priceless, you know?
Yeah.
Not to mention
But there's somebody on the other line you still don't know about, right?
Right, yeah.
That's another plot thread that we need to figure out.
Yeah. So if I do pick up some more issues in that storyline, I'll save and talk about them here.
Or I can read it for you and tell you what happens next issue.
Yeah, if you want to. You have to find them first, though.
I think the Supermans are pretty easy. They're in the upstairs closet. I think.
There's just comics everywhere you go in your house.
Okay, so my next book is also, it's a DC book. It's a DC imprint book. It's Helix's The Black Lamb. And like I said, Helix was a Vertigo-esque attempt at the sci-fi realm. And I guess it didn't last too long because I was able to complete most of it. I think their longest running one was Vermilion, which sounds like the band Marillion. But they offered a few titles. One of them was The Black Lamb, which was a Tim Truman, written and drawn Tim Truman. And I'm a fan of Tim Truman's. The other one was Cyberella, who was written by Howard Chaykin and had art by Don Cameron. And then Gemini Blood, which was written by Christopher Haynes with Tommy Lee Edwards art. Vermilion was a team that I didn't know. It was Lucius Shepard and Al Davison. And Bloody Mary was Garth Ennis with art by Carlos Esquerra. So Bloody Mary and Black Lamb were the two limited series. The other three you could actually subscribe to. They were ongoings. So this isn't anything like I thought it would be, this Black Lamb. I thought it would be more sci-fi, but it almost turned more horror because the Black Lamb, if you look at him, he looks like he's got vampire teeth and he's got like bird-like talons for his feet and hands. And he always carries a staff. And the scene opens up like in the 18th century, and it's very much like a horror movie scene where you got the guys with the pickets and stuff, and they're all marching into an evil castle, and there's this one guy who's a vampire killer that proceeds to kill the lead vampire, his wife, and a little child. He drives stake through their hearts, and puts garlic in their mouth, and he pretty much fucks them out. And there's one guy that's watching as these vampires are being killed or massacred, and it's the Black Lamb. And then we cut to the future, and it doesn't say what year, but it looks like way in the future. And there's this girl who's watching the TVs and just listening to the news about various newscasts. And one of them was in a sector, you know, bodies were found in Sector 8, tenement fighter. The victims' heads were decapitated and police are still investigating. And she sees these three mysterious characters coming by and she does this weird little grin like she knows who those characters are. Well, it turns out these characters are vampire hunters. And they're getting ready to kill more vampires. And the interesting thing here is they're being hunted at the same time by the Black Lamb. So as they're hunting vampires, they're being hunted. And the Black Lamb actually captures them and massacres the two guys and leaves the main guy for trial. And it's pretty cool because he takes him onto a trial of monsters. So the whole court is all monster based. You got like Frankensteins and Igors and all these different creatures, werewolves and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde's and all these crazy things. And they got a little fairy protecting the defense, who's this vampire killer, and they basically strap his mouth to this iron vice so he can't say a word anyway. It just like mumbles like woof, woof, woof. And the Court of Monsters puts him on trial and essentially sentences him to death. And that one girl that you saw watching the TVs and stuff, it was her doing. It's like she told the Court of Monsters about this guy, and he was killing fellow vampires. So they pretty much massacre this dude, and they said, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" And it's like blah blah blah, because he can't say anything. He's got an iron vice over his mouth, and they pretty much throw him into this fire pit from hell, and kill him. And that's how the first issue ends. So it's an interesting monster sci-fi book. I didn't know what I was getting, but it was interesting. Beautifully drawn art. If you're a fan of Tim Truman, who I know from like Hawk World and a lot of his other stuff that I've been reading, he's done some stuff for IDW recently. He's really, really good. But it was a good series, and it was a crazy courtroom scene. I'm not going to get into all of it, but it was pretty insane with all the monsters. They had a mummy and all kinds of shit. Lead prosecutor was Dr. Jekyll looking. He started off as a human and then turned into Mr. Hyde. But it was nice. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty different than I would expect from sci-fi.
Yeah.
But that's pretty cool. The only thing I had left was, I didn't do last time, but was my Star Trek report.
Uh-huh.
Was just checking in on that. I had watched 7 episodes since the last time I talked about it. There was, just to mention a few of them, Wolf in the Fold. This is where Scotty ends up accused of killing women on this planet that kind of has a Middle Eastern culture to it. And it starts out with a pretty funny scene because there's Scott and McCoy and Kirk are all watching a belly dancer and are pretty into it. And Scott himself is picked up by the dancer and leaves with her, and she gets killed. And so it's a bit of a murder mystery and trying to clear Scott's name. It's definitely not a, definitely wasn't an episode that would stand up today in terms of the way that women and other cultures are treated. You know, it shows the fact that it was a long time ago in terms of when it was written and stuff. The Trouble with Tribbles, obviously this is the very famous episode with the Tribbles and stuff. And I guess some people at the time, I don't think this is an opinion that has continued as time has gone on, you know, thought it was kind of silly at the time, but I thought it was a really, really great episode and was a lot of fun. And I mean, one of the things that I'm enjoying about Star Trek is it can do a lot of, even though it's a science fiction show, it can do a lot of different emotions and stuff. And I know obviously a lot has been said about this episode, but I really like this scene where, because Scott, I enjoy Scotty. There's a good scene with Scotty where he's in the bar with Chekhov and he's telling Chekhov, you know, not to get in trouble and not to get in any bar fights and stuff. And then Scott is the one that ends up getting in a bar fight because somebody insults the Enterprise. And he's the one that
Kirk told to, you know, keep an eye on everybody and make sure nobody gets in trouble, and he's the one that ends up causing the trouble. Let's see what else there was. The immunity syndrome was an interesting episode. This one, there's this USS Intrepid that is a total Vulcan ship, and Spock gets affected by the fact that 400 Vulcans have been killed. There's a sort of that mind connection between the Vulcan species that allows Spock to sense it and be affected by it. Spock ends up piloting a shuttlecraft to get close to this large, thousands of miles wide amoeba that is in space that they think might be feeding off of energy. And so Spock figures out that he can probably destroy it from the inside. They end up having to take the Enterprise into this amoeba like looking creature and Scotty makes an antimatter bomb that they use to explode the creature. So this is kind of a science-y, interesting episode. And then just one other is was a private little war where they... it's one of these episodes where they are dealing with the more primitive culture. And Kirk had been there when he was in his training years. It's like part of a project where he goes and stays with the culture, but doesn't influence them. But when they get there, they notice that they have, they're surprised to see that they have flintlock guns, which is a more advanced technology than they had at the time that he was there. And this character that called Tyree that Kirk was friends with when he was there, they recognize each other, but Tyree is being really influenced by this woman named Nona. By this actress called Nancy Kovac that was on a lot of TV at the time. And so it ends up being kind of one of those situations where they're trying to best decide how to help this culture, because the Klingons are involved, and the Klingons are not showing any compulsions about influencing. You know, they don't have that prime directive that the Enterprise does, so Kirk wants to sort of keep them in pace with their enemies on the planet. But there's a lot of arguments to whether that's the right thing to do and stuff. So, I guess this was meant to be an allegory about the Vietnam War. Historically, that makes it kind of interesting to watch it with that viewpoint. I read that it was even more, like, the original script was even more explicit about making references to the Vietnam War, and they sort of toned those down a little bit, but you can still watch it with that perspective and see some interesting comments about that. So. I slowed down a little bit in how frequently I've been watching episodes, but I'm still enjoying them a lot. I got 7 more episodes in season 2 of original series. And then it looks like season 3 is a little bit shorter.
And then you're
still
done.
A lot of episodes, though.
Then you got to get into the movies.
Yeah, so it'll be a while still. It's season 3 is shorter, but there's still a lot of episodes. But I'm digging it. I'm becoming a Trekkie.
You're going to go to the Trek conventions. You're not going to Heroes, right?
Right, but I've already got save money set aside for Baltimore. So
Heroes is just around the corner.
I know. I wish I was going to that because it's sooner, but Baltimore would be a lot easier, but that's a pretty definite plan.
Very cool.
So,
all right. Well, that kind of wraps us up for this episode of Geek Brunch Retro.
Yep.
And I'm going to have a little dinner mint to celebrate.
Oh, I was wondering. Mm. I heard you unwrapping something.
Yeah.
I was hoping it wasn't a condom.
Mylar.
Mylar after dinner mint. That sounds tasty.
That's right. You can reach us at MythMakingETC, at Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter. You can send us questions for, we'll accumulate them and talk about them on the episode. You could also go to Facebook and like the Geek Brunch podcast page, where we also host Geek Brunch and Geek Brunch Retro there. We post all the episode threads there. And our website is geekbrunchpodcast.com. Emails, mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And Mike@comicbooknoise.com. I haven't podcasted, it seems like forever. I'm not used to this.
You're rusty.
Although we podcasted early this week, right? Or was it last week?
Last week, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a week and a half ago. It still seems like we went from it seeming like it had been a long time since we recorded, mm-hmm. and then this time it seemed like pretty short, but not that that's a bad thing. But yeah,
only 3 more episodes of Buck Rogers. A lot of feedback on, yeah.
Wow.
No, 4.
4. Okay.
We got the next episode. I can't even pronounce. It's like Shigorgwats.
Gotta
yell it. Shigorgwats.
I have no idea. I'm curious just to see what that even refers to.
The Hand of Goral, Testimony for a Traitor, and the Dorian Secret.
Secret Circle.
Secret Circle. All right. So,
yeah,
so
tune in next time for Sigorath.
Yeah. I hope that one's a good one.
The Woman and the Wine.
Has Alex Hyde White. Didn't we just have him?
Yeah, I think he...
Is he playing a different character now?
Yeah, I think they just use him to play different people on the ship or something. He plays different characters. That's weird. But I guess they had a pretty low budget.
Yeah.
No, what can you do?
Oh, no, I'm looking at the wrong episode. He's not in it.
Oh,
no,
he is
in it, yeah.
He is in
it says
more than one episode.
Another ensign. Yeah.
Yeah, but not as the same character. but similar characters, like not totally different ones.
Yeah, they just call him something different. Hey, there's the guy in the red shirt, right, for Star Trek.
Yeah, I'd like to. We could conjecture maybe that besides the characters that we see on the Searcher, all of them are clones of Alex Hyde White and the rest of the ship. The other 300 something people are Alex Hyde White clones.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, this has been a fun one, and we will talk to you again in a week or 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
Couple weeks.
Yeah, because I will still be here in 2 weeks.
Yes, it'll be the weekend before
it's
Heroes.
The weekend before Heroes, yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, have a good one,
right.
Chris, and
until
we'll talk
then,
to you
my
soon.
Friend.
Yep.
All right.
Bye-bye.